Hello and welcome to Beth Tikkun and the Spiritual Seasons series. With this group of teachings, we are exploring the Torah portions in relation to the calendar as a whole and God's overall pattern of salvation. This week we are in Parsha Korach, which is numbers 16 to 18. Korach is Korah in English. I'll probably switch back and forth. This is the portion where we read about the rebellion fomented especially by Korah and several from the tribe of Reuben, including the brothers Dathan and Abiram. Korah was from the tribe of Levi and was apparently a first cousin to Moses and Aaron. These who led the rebellion convinced 250 well-known chiefs from Israel to stand with them against Moses and Aaron. They accused them of going too far in establishing only Aaron's line as the priests in Israel. They say that the whole nation is holy. Dathan and Abiram point to the fact that Moses had not brought them into a land of milk and honey, and they refused to even go talk to Moses. Once again, God threatens to wipe out the nation, but Moses and Aaron intercede. And in the end, Moses declares that all would know who has despised the Lord if God creates a new thing by opening the ground beneath the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. Immediately, the land swallows them and their families, though it would seem that Korah's sons did not stand with their father and were not killed, because later we have some psalms that are written by the sons of Korah. So the next day, somewhat unbelievably, the people grumble against Moses and Aaron, saying that they had killed people of the Lord. Again, God threatens to consume the nation, and this time Aaron stands in the gap by himself there. But almost 15,000 die from a plague. And so imagine the scope of this. What is required to simply bury 15,000 people all at once so that the wilderness animals don't get at the bodies? It's just unbelievable. God then devises a test that is designed to demonstrate clearly who he has chosen for the priesthood. The 12 chiefs of the tribes each carve their names into a rod, with the rod from the tribe of Levi bearing Aaron's name. God says, "And the staff of the man whom I choose shall sprout. Thus I will make to cease from me the grumblings of the people of Israel, which they grumble against you." The next day the rods are brought out, and only Aaron's had budded and blossomed and even produced almonds. This staff is placed, you know, eventually in the ark as a reminder of who God had clearly chosen for the responsibility of the priesthood. It would seem that the people were utterly convinced by this point of their error and despaired of even drawing near to God at all. In answer to them expressing, you know, this, we're undone, the text says, God makes clear that the tribe of Levi and the Aaronic priesthood would bear any guilt connected to the sanctuary and the priesthood. In the last part of the portion, God gives to the Levites and the priesthood the resources they would need to live and do their work, including the tithes and offerings from the people. Well, before we get into the text a bit deeper, I'd like to talk about the new month that we have just entered, Tammuz, because by God's design, the month sets the tone for spiritual growth in the month. And so we've just come through the summer solstice as Tammuz is beginning, and this is a vital piece of information. This is a vital context for the whole month of Tammuz and for understanding the season. On the summer solstice, which is the official beginning of summer for the Northern Hemisphere, the sun's rays are hitting the earth directly at the northernmost point, right? Those direct rays of the sun are going back and forth across the equator throughout the year. And so on the summer solstice is when they are as far north hitting directly as they will go. And that is the Tropic of Cancer, that line. So the Tropic of Cancer actually comes very near to the U.S. It passes through the Bahamas and just north of Cuba, so between Cuba and Florida. And so that's why southern Florida has technically a tropical climate. Well, maybe not technically. It's not technically in the tropics, but it does have a tropical climate. So the summer solstice is the longest day of the year for the northern hemisphere, meaning we have more light on that day than any other day in the year. After summer starts, the sun's direct rays begin moving south again. So the first day of summer is actually the very longest day of the year. So the increased light in this season is the key to the month of Tammuz. This is because more light helps us to see. So this is a month about vision, when vision is most powerful for us. And that can be good, or it can cause big problems if we use our sense of sight wrongly at this time. And we see this problematic use of sight in this Torah portion of Korach. So again, this choice for how we use our enhanced vision now is the key to the season, this choice. If we use that enhanced vision to see what is good, and in humility to see what needs correcting in us, leading to repentance, then this month can be used powerfully for our growth. And so humility, again, is the key to helping us to see in the proper way at this time. It's also good to use our vision at this time to see beyond the surface of others to the goodness in them. Well, on the other hand, if we are arrogant, right? Opposite of humility, if we're kind of in a place of pride, and if we allow the Yetzer Hara to rise up in us and influence our vision in this month, we can be very powerfully led to destruction in this month. And we can be led to the sensual passions, especially, which are associated with heat Hebraically. Or we can only see the natural and fail to see in wholeness a person. We can be led astray as Korah was. So there's a great potential to go one way or the other now. Tammuz has, it needs to be walked especially carefully and with a special humility so that the powerful potential of the month isn't turned toward chaos and destruction, but is instead turned to life and growth. So let's talk about a few connections to the month of Tammuz that the sages have made over the centuries. We'll see that they all work together around this central theme of vision. So the most obvious connection is the hush of the month, what I call the bodily ability that the ancient that from ancient times have been associated with each month. So as I mentioned in a previous teaching, the hush of Tammuz is in fact the sense of sight, its vision. So we are being enabled not only to see inwardly what needs correcting, but also to see what is good in others, as I mentioned before, and leading to us speaking that out and helping to bring that good out of others at this time. Well, beyond the hush, the mazel of Tammuz is Sartan, the crab, or Cancer. So remember that the important line on the globe that marks our summer is called the Tropic of Cancer. And Rabbi Yitzhak Ginsburg says the word Sartan is understood as being composed of two words, Sar and Tan, which literally translate to remove the body. So the crab has an exoskeleton that confines it to a certain size, preventing it from growing further. In order to grow, it has to shed that exoskeleton. And so this makes it naked and vulnerable for a time, but it's necessary for it to grow. And so that will, after it sheds its exoskeleton, it will grow very quickly before a new exoskeleton forms. And Rabbi Ginsburg says that the crab is speaking to us about removing the body to reveal the soul beneath. Removing the outer shell. Remember, we're talking about vision here. Vision. He says it's about removing the outer shell of reality by means of the power of concentrated sight to reveal what's good inside and the inner life force. Well, that word cancer, we don't normally talk about it in terms of the Tropic of Cancer or the Mazel of Cancer. It's the name of a disease, and that disease involves uncontrolled growth. So again, there's a lot of potential here for chaos. So Rabbi Ginsburg is looking at the more positive side by talking about removing the body to reveal the soul beneath. But another set of boundaries for us beyond the body is the Torah. If someone casts off the shell of the Torah that protects him, then that person is free to grow according to the impulse that they have to grow, but that growth will be uncontrolled and disorganized and unhealthy and ultimately deadly. So this is what cancer does in the body. It's a mass of cells that can't control their growth. And so I want to connect to this idea of casting off the protective shell of the Torah, the unfortunate decision by modern society to make June Pride Month. Pride is the great enemy, especially at this time of year, which we have been connecting to the phase of adolescence, right? Pride is the great nemesis for the teenager. It is humility that we seek now, not pride. It is submission to authority and submission to God's word that we are to emphasize now as we seek to utilize the great energy of this time of year for life and not death. Pride Month is a slap in the face of the one who created us. It is a casting off of the yoke of the Torah, and it leads to a kind of unchecked growth, a cancer that causes death. Now is a time to draw near to the boundaries of the Torah and the spiritual leadership placed over us who can help to steer us through this season. The enemy would have a rift form between ourselves and our leadership now, as we see in Parsha Korach. So we have to actively work against that rift happening in this season. Well, the last attribute of the month of Tammuz I'll mention today is the tribe that is associated, the tribe that's associated with the month, and that's Reuben, right? Each of the 12 months has a tribe associated with it. Reuben means see a son. So we have yet another clear connection to sight here with the tribe. Reuben also helps us to see the specific area where we are prone to falling in this month. And I would call it passion. Reuben's downfall is his passion that gets the better of him and leads him to sin against his father. Passion, and we could describe passion as just an inflamed emotional state. Passion is connected to heat, and we now enter the heat of high summer. And passion is also connected to this idea of Pride Month. Is it not? And so these two big ideas of passion and sight are connected like two brothers. Passion often starts with an eye that wanders where it shouldn't go, or the reverse is true. A person is filled with unchecked passion that leads their eyes to places they should not look. This is a season where we need to be particularly vigilant to guard our eyes to see only that which is good and modest. In this way, we work to bring correction to our sense of vision at this time. So let's do some thinking now to place Korach in the flow of the calendar. This portion is a bit of a train wreck. Let's start opening the heart of the Parsha through the name. Korach means both bald and ice. The sages especially connect the name to the idea of baldness, which is not just being bald, but also plucking out to make bald. So you make either a bald spot or making something entirely bald. The Jewish Encyclopedia says that the rabbis teach that the name was given to Korah on account of the gap or blank which he made in Israel by his revolt. So rather than maybe thinking of Korah as being bald, Korah creates baldness. His thoughts are filled with pride and jealousy. And when he sees with his eyes that the time is right in Israel to gain power, he acts by taking hold of the leading men of Israel in such a strong way that they end up being uprooted from Israel, right? Plucked out, a bald spot made. In his pride, he becomes the vessel for removing these leaders from the safety and submission to their leaders, Moses and Aaron, and therefore submission to God, right? They come out from under submission to God when they come out from under submission to Moses and Aaron. So in the end, all these men die, more than 250 of Israel's leaders. And this is followed by the connected loss of 14,700 people in a plague. So this is a great tragedy indeed, with many tents in Israel missing people after it's all said and done. Many fathers, many mothers missing in Israel. How many children were left without parents to guide them because of this rebellion? And this idea of taking hold of the people is found in the unusual use of the Hebrew word for took at the beginning of the portion, which says that Korah and some others took, but it doesn't say what they took. So listen for this in the first verses of the portion. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, son of Kohath, son of Levi, and Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Pelet, sons of Reuben, took. And they rose up before Moses with a number of the people of Israel, 250 chiefs of the congregation, chosen from the assembly, well-known men. So the question is obviously asked, well, what did they take? They took men. Korah took men. And in taking them, he made a bald spot in Israel. So I think the other meaning for the name Korach, which is ice, also helps us to understand what's going on here. In general, coldness is understood to be emotional coldness. And so if this is a time for rectification of our emotions, we can err in two directions. We're prone to being emotionally overheated, but we can equally err in not allowing our emotions to inform our mind, for example, and give us some balance. And so Korah, I'm going to presume that being that his name also means ice, he is perhaps a kind of an icy intellectual sort and one whose thinking is not touched by the warmth of love. And one way to understand what's happening here is that maybe it's the case that the people themselves generally are just filled with a kind of emotional passion and they are attracted to Korah because his cold intellect can give a controlled voice to the emotions they are feeling. And so again, the summer is a time for heat, and heat is associated with passion. And the people are upset that God has just sentenced them to 40 years in the wilderness. Their emotions are running high, and they're looking around, and they're wanting to take that out on someone. And they look at Aaron, and they say, why are you the priest? And all that bubbling emotion will find an outlet. An outlet that is capable of channeling that energy, and Korah is the guy. So this person named Ice, he's just the right mouthpiece for them because he's not so connected to this heat and can apply a kind of cold logic to the growing unease of the people. And Korah is well-placed to be used by the people. He's the first cousin of Moses and Aaron, and he was apparently well-respected. And tradition even adds that he was extremely wealthy. And so there's a modern saying in Hebrew that if you're calling someone rich, you say he's as rich as Korah. And so here's this one who can speak well. You know, Korah is good at speaking. He can express the angst of the people to Moses and Aaron, partly because he's ice, right? He's cold. And the sages admit that Korah's argument is quite logical, actually. He says that the whole congregation is holy. So why should only Aaron be given the priesthood? Hadn't God even said that they would be a nation of priests? Well, logic in itself is not evil. It's a blessing, in fact. The problem here is that their logic is not being bound and limited by the word of God to Israel. It's fine and good to be logical, but what has God said about the situation? The intellect must be bound by the Torah, and when it's not, it runs amok. Love is another way to balance the intellect, but on the other hand, the primary way to give a boundary to the intellect is God's word. It's the Torah. Well, the intellect unbounded by God's limits makes people become animals. The unlimited intellect makes people become animals. How many madmen in history have we seen that were gifted with great intelligence, but who rejected God? And in the end, their intelligence becomes twisted into little more than an excuse-making machine to indulge the flesh. They become stupid, and much worse. Some people become, this kind of person becomes calloused and capable of the most heinous crimes against humanity because their unchecked human reasoning leads them to operate according to the rules of nature, right? Might makes right, without the balance of the laws of the spiritual domain. They become animals as their intellect is bent to the lusts of the flesh and as their logic leads them to devalue and use in a very utilitarian way the people around them. And woe to the person near such animal men who is weak or inconvenient or inefficient. Or the opposite, maybe those who are gifted and are therefore competition, right? Nature and the laws of nature, it's all about competition. All of these people, whether they're weak or whether they're especially strong, all of them need to be eliminated. And as such arrogant people fall further and further into the pit of the uncontrolled flesh, they become absolutely convinced that what they are doing is the height of logic. So human logic is a gift, but when it's not bounded by the constraints of the Torah, it is a slippery slope that leads to all kinds of evil. And we are certainly seeing that today in our society at large. The world rides the rainbow headlong into the maw of this madness. Animal lusts go unchecked, and logic is twisted to become the exact opposite of true logic, to the point that children are being maimed in the name of compassion. Parents who follow God and his ways are having children removed by the state. The state takes like Korah took. Friends, the hour grows late as our world teeters on the brink of absolute moral collapse, and the speed of the fall is accelerating. But even as we notice these vast shifts in our culture, which is increasingly a single world culture, thanks to the internet, we need to always be seeing and exposing the Korah within ourselves. Is there a kind of pride lurking in us that likes to buck the authority and take others with us in doing that? And so we always need to turn the enemies of Israel. You know, we need to look inward for those enemies always. Well, let's come back now to the spiritual season at hand. Beyond these ideas of unchecked passion in the body that finds an outlet through Korah, creating a vast bald spot in Israel, the idea of baldness itself also quite obviously speaks of uncovering what is hidden. This idea of illumination and sight and vision, seeing what has been covered before. So the hair on the head hides and protects the skin of the head. which more than the skin elsewhere on the body can quickly become overexposed to the sun. One benefit of hair is that it hides the head or whatever part of the body from being overexposed to the light of the sun. So Kora speaks to both the passions of this summer season and the illumination of this season, this great light and exposing what was in darkness that happens in this season. He becomes a channel for those passions, and through him, a great pride that leads to death is revealed within the nation. It's illuminated. This needs to be seen. This needs to come out into the open, what is bubbling there in Israel. And so through Kora, at this time in the calendar, this time of great light, this exposure of this pride happens. And they can see very quickly how it leads to death. Well, let's connect now some of these ideas to the phase of growth called adolescence. We keep coming back to this because it's one of, you know, human development is one of our main ways to understand the calendar. And so we've said that this phase of adolescence begins at the Moed of Shavuot, which we celebrated not that long ago. So the adolescent is particularly susceptible to the kind of pride that leads to bucking authority. This is because suddenly it becomes apparent that they are independent, that they have enough knowledge and ability to process the world on their own, at least they think, and they don't have to just receive what's given to them from those on high. This transition to independent thinking is a necessary step toward maturity, but it's a very, very precarious moment. As the teen begins thinking independently, he or she inevitably begins to question the choices the authorities are making and the choices that authorities have made in the past. How did I get here? Why have I been doing it this way? Why do I have to do my chores? You know, all of these things. So pride springs up in the teen and must be exposed for the deadly poison it is. Teens also are particularly challenged by inflamed passions as the body matures and as they grapple with relationships that suddenly feel much more complex, right? They enter their middle school, their high school, and it's just a web of all these relationships that are overwhelming to them sometimes. So the teen tends to give far too much weight to the opinions of their peers, and their peers inevitably will let them down. So the teen needs to learn to see past the surface and into the heart, and that takes time. So the place of safety for an adolescent is to humbly draw near to the spiritual authorities over them who can help to guide them through the difficulties of this phase. They need to fight with all their beings this rebellious spirit that springs to life with much greater strength at this time of life. A young child will also test the parent and purposefully disobey, but it really becomes much more of a battle in that realm when we become teenagers, this wanting to rebel against authority. So what do? You push against that and you draw near to your spiritual authority and you build in yourself a respect, a renewed respect for them, right, now that you're independently thinking. So to button up this part of our study today with a practical suggestion, let me encourage us all to be especially supportive of the spiritual authority placed over us now, not just the adolescents among us, especially a good word for them right now, but for all of us. Let's be especially supportive of our spiritual authority now in this moment when we are reading Parsha Korach and in this general season. Encourage your leaders. Let them know that you trust that God is acting and speaking through them. One way to counter the energy of Korach in the world now is to recommit to following and protecting and lifting up and coming alongside to help the spiritual authority God has chosen for us. Actively be on guard against a judgmental spirit now. Last week we talked about rejecting fear and pressing in on the path God has put before us, and I think fear is really beneath Oh, they're leading us astray, right? They're making the wrong decisions. And so really fear is kind of a base emotion here that's driving a lot. But one way that we reject that fear and we press in on the path God has given us is to be supportive of our leaders who are entrusted with helping to clarify our path for us. Well, I'd like to spend a bit more time now on this idea of submitting to spiritual authority. God has been speaking to me about this area of my walk recently in this season. It's not that I have much trouble submitting to the ultimate decisions of the authority God has placed over me, but what God is especially illuminating for me this year is how careful we have to be with our tone when even discussing with these leaders before the decisions are made, especially when we are speaking with them publicly, but with any communications with our leaders, private or public. We can undermine our leaders when we are using an overly familiar tone, for example, with them, or maybe an overly blunt tone with them, which has a little bit of disrespect in it. So a person might be fine abiding by the decisions of the elders, but there's more to submitting than just accepting the final decisions without grumbling. Accepting the decisions of the leaders without grumbling is kind of the base level submission to authority. And we see here in Numbers, Israel struggling with that level, with the base level of submission. But they are on the path to learning. And these lessons regarding spiritual authority can be very painful ones for us to grasp and learn. The missteps here are very costly for Israel. The truth is that there's a real art to submitting to spiritual authority. And I'm no expert here, but we can draw at least a few guiding principles out of the text here in Parsha Korach. So first of all, it's clear that the people don't quite recognize how offensive they are being to God when they are grumbling about Moses and Aaron, God's chosen leaders, or worse, when they're openly challenging them. The only real mouthpieces for God here are Moses and, to a lesser extent, Aaron, and clearly the people are doubting that they are being faithful messengers. They assume Moses is guilty of some kind of cronyism when he declares that God's will is for his older brother, Aaron, to be the one and only beginning of the priestly line. So they question that, and they don't realize that in questioning Moses, God takes that as a direct questioning of himself. So listen to this verse from Numbers 5, which that's probably not the right chapter there, but this verse that equates grumbling, it's actually Numbers 17:5. And so in this verse, God equates the grumbling against Moses to grumbling against him. And it says, "And the staff of the man whom I choose shall sprout. Thus I will make to cease from me the grumblings of the people of Israel, which they grumble against you." And so in God's mind, speaking against Moses is speaking against him. It's one and the same thing. And so, in fact, the people complain against Moses practically from the start, even in Egypt, when, you know, Pharaoh increases their workload. So even from the beginning, it's difficult for them to fully recognize that when God entrusts a human with representing himself to the people, he's really entrusting that person to be his face and mouth to the people. He takes it very personally when we speak against that authority. And so number one, recognize that God's chosen leaders are representing God, and grumbling against them or undermining them is like doing that against God himself. So that point alone should really give us pause when we are ready to speak to or speak about our leaders. So we're assuming here in this discussion that the leaders are good leaders and are not clearly in sin or themselves somehow in rebellion against God. If the leaders are caught up in willful sin, you should get out from under that leadership and find a different leadership to come under. But barring that sort of situation, safety for the flock is found in submitting to the shepherds who represent God's will to us, even if they're wrong. God will not take lightly a rebellious spirit against the elders. Let them be wrong. God will work it out in the end. The surest way to bring down condemnation on your own head is to buck your spiritual authority. Pray and let God work it out if you think the authorities are getting a bit off track. God will bring about the correction if it's needed. Now, we can also give input, particularly when we are asked for input, and good leaders will seek the input of the flock. And this is because the body has organs and senses that the head does not have. A hand has a certain way of experiencing the world, right? A very hands-on way that the head does not have. The head must be receptive to data coming from all over the body. And it's the head's responsibility to sort through all of that information and to weigh it and in the end make a decision. The hand has only very limited information. So the hand is not in a position to make a very good decision. It's the head that's in that position. So the body should be trying to communicate with the head, and the head should be seeking that input. But we just have to be careful to communicate with the head respectfully, especially if we're giving feedback publicly. But always, our interactions with elders can undermine them just with our tone, let alone our words. So of course, our tone is going to be based on our thoughts, our thought life. So guarding our attitudes toward our spiritual authority starts with guarding our thoughts about them. So be generous in your thinking and be humble. Fight pride when it starts to crop up. Understand that the elder's perspective is more expansive than yours. Understand that God is pleased when we submit to our authority, and he's particularly unhappy when we undermine them, even slightly. And be thankful that the burden of leadership isn't on your shoulders. It's a heavy yoke. And so in this portion, the people finally seem to get it. And they say to Moses, basically, "Oi, you know, how can any of us come before God now? We're all dead. You know, we're dead people. We've really messed up here." And so apparently in answer to this comment from the people, God speaks directly to Aaron. And he says, "You and your sons and your father's house with you shall bear iniquity connected with the sanctuary, and you and your sons with you shall bear iniquity connected with your priesthood." The answer to the people who have seen their error and are now reluctant to draw near to God is, "No, don't worry about it. Draw near to me. It's the Levites in general who will bear the iniquity of the sanctuary, and it's Aaron and his sons in particular who will bear the iniquity of the priesthood." And so this removes a great burden from the people. But recognize that this is a burden that is taken from you, and it's placed on your leaders. It is they who will be held accountable when the flock draws near to him. And so because of this responsibility, they must spend a lot of time and energy in lengthy discussions and in prayer as they guide the flock. It's a lot of work that they have to do there. So lastly, on this topic for today, and particularly coming out of this portion, trust that God is indeed empowering your leaders to do the right thing. You likely won't sense how God is empowering them. You just have to trust that he is doing so. And we can see this empowering of the leaders here in this portion. After God puts this burden on the Levites and on the priesthood, he then literally gives them everything they need to do the work of leading the people. He gives tithes to the non-priestly Levites, and he gives the non-priestly Levites to the priest. He gives those people, all the rest of the tribe of Levi, to the priest to help them in the work of the sanctuary. And he gives parts of the consecrated things to the priests. He gives them the best of the harvests, the first fruits, the best of the oil and of the wine and of the grain. He even gives them the first fruits of man and beast, though the firstborn of men are to be redeemed with money. So it's a powerful example of how God empowers the leaders he calls to lead. Trust that he is likewise empowering your own leaders. Once again, let's use the extra light being given to us now to see the good in those around us, and particularly the good in our spiritual authority now. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe uses his great ability to see past the surface, to see the goodness underneath when he reads and comments on Parsha Korach. In one case, he even brings out the goodness in the rebels. Recall that the 250 die, and God instructs Moses to take the censers they used to offer incense to him and beat them into plates to cover the altar. The censers had become holy because they were used as vessels to make offerings to God. Offering incense to God is something that only the priests are to do. The priesthood had been specially consecrated and made holy in order to bring such offerings like the incense. They had to be consecrated so that they wouldn't die while doing that work. Well, these 250 men were not consecrated in that way to this holy service. So when they brought these incense offerings directly to God, they died. However, the censers themselves became holy. And Rabbi Schneerson says that though these mutineers acted sinfully and were severely punished, beneath their complaint was a desire to come close to God. They were misguided in doing that, but there was a root desire for nearness to God there. And he says that we should look at those censers that are elevated here to a place of honor on the altar and see that God's desire is much more than elevating pieces of metal. He wants to elevate human souls, which are infinitely more precious. So even though the censers were used in this misguided way, God still found a way to elevate them. And if he found a way to use the censers, he won't give up on us either. We're much more precious to him than those pieces of metal. Again, so this is a rabbi who can see the good in people, and he's seeing the good in these rebellious 250 men here, and how their censers were used as a covering for the altar. And so Rabbi Schneerson is an example to us of how we are to use the great light of this time to see. He says, look at the root there. They are trying to draw near to God. Well, let's turn our focus now directly to Yeshua. To start, Yeshua has quite a lot to say about the eye and vision. For one thing, in the Sermon on the Mount, Yeshua says that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. And he also says that if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. Yeshua heals the blind, so he's the antidote to lack of vision. And he reproves the religious leaders by calling them blind guides. So he points out where vision is lacking. Beyond these explicit teachings, though, about the eye and vision, I want to make a couple of other points connecting Yeshua to the portion and to the season. The first kind of bounces off of Grant and Robin's discussion this week. So Robin mentions the contrast between how Korah is taken down into the earth and Yeshua ascends into heaven. The one goes down, the other goes up. So the point I want to make here is one we've talked about in this series recently, the idea that God allows us to create our own reality here on this earth. God is the creator, and he has made us in his image. And he puts us here in this place, and he says, now you create a reality. Some people create heaven on earth. Others create hell. In truth, we are each crafting a world with elements of both heaven and hell all the time. But if we are growing in the Lord, then we are slowly learning how to more and more craft a world around us and within us that is heaven on earth. And we are less and less building a hell. With every choice we make for life or death, we are adding another brick that is either making a heavenly palace or a hellish pit. That's not to say that there isn't one actual reality created by God. There's just one reality. What we are trying to do here is to build a replica of the true reality, build a mirror image of the spiritual realm here on earth. Well, Korach and those with him chose to focus on what they could see, the material realm alone, and it led them astray. It led them into a lie. they put their vision on Moses instead of the God who stands behind Moses. And what they crafted was a world in which Moses and Aaron were power-hungry liars. They chose to craft and believe in a reality that functioned only by the lowly laws of nature, right? Nature would say, if I'm Moses, if I'm Aaron, I'm going to take advantage of my situation in this case so I can accumulate resources for myself. In the end, they were swallowed up. Korach and the others were swallowed up by that lowly reality. Yeshua, on the other hand, ascended beyond the earth. But he's going to return and dwell here and rule with us. So the final point I want to make here in connection to Yeshua is a link to the physical season, especially the physical season in Israel now. It's a tough time physically in the Holy Land now, but it's not without a cord of hope. The rains are finished. The heat is building. The land turns yellow and begins to crack. Israel will go for about 6 months with almost no rain, if you can imagine. 6 months, we just had 3 weeks here in Ohio. It was record-setting, no rain. And it was terrible, really. And this lack of rain is described as a separation of the heavens and the earth. The heavens and the earth are separated from each other. The rain is a connection from above to below. It's a fertilization of the land that comes from above. And that connection is severed now, but not entirely. You see, even when the rain stops, the dew remains. All the way through this severe dryness, this disconnection, God faithfully provides the dew. And it's a lifeline in Israel. Many plants and animals survive at this time simply off the dew that God generously provides now. So again, though we stumble, though the Korach in us sometimes gets the better of us, God never leaves us without a lifeline, a cord of hope. And here's the connection I see to Yeshua with this. The word for dew in Hebrew is tal, from talal, which means to cover or to strew over. The dew is strewn across the land to cover it. And cover reminds us of Kippur, which also means to cover. In Israel and wherever we are in the world now, we can look at the dew and how it covers so thoroughly, and we can be reminded that the real covering is coming, Yom Kippur. This constant covering of the dew is a lifeline and a message of hope that helps to sustain us on our way to the next encounter with our spiritual covering, a time when we are reconnected to God by the blood of the Messiah, and when we are further empowered to walk in victory. Well, that's all for today. Thanks again for listening. Below the video is a link to an outline of this teaching. May God bless us with a great desire to draw near to and support our spiritual authority at this time. And may He increase our sensitivity to how we think about them and engage with them. And may He grant us a great ability to see beneath the surface now, to see what needs adjusting in our lives, and to see what is good in others around us. And may we rise up to be the people He has made us to be. Shalom.